Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
How different would your life be if you lived cradle to grave on the move at the speed of your own footsteps? You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Of the estimated 30 to 40 million nomads in the modern world, the largest ethnic group is that of the Fulani people. They raise cattle for a living, walking many miles each year with their herds from savanna in the rainy season to wetlands when it's dry, camping in portable huts, and owning no land. Ambivalent about money, they are dependent on the whims of nature for survival. If the rains fail and the cattle die, they too face starvation. My guest spent a year with a band of Fulani in Mali, learning about their livelihood and culture, documenting their clashes with and concessions to the way more settled countrymen live, and observing a striking and admirable stoicism in the face of suffering and loss. The new book by journalist Anna Bodkin is called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. Anna, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
When did you first become aware of the Fulani and how they lived? And what was it that grabbed your attention and wouldn't let go so that you knew you ultimately would have to spend some time with them?
I was working on a book in northern Afghanistan that was set in a desert, a landscape very much like the Sahel in West Africa. And the people I was working with at the time had been nomadic at one point in their existence, but in the last 200 years they had settled and become carpet weavers and opium dealers. And I thought, what would it be like to spend some time in this kind of landscape with people who live at the pace of 3 miles an hour? What is it like to experience the world at 3 miles an hour? Because this is evolutionarily what we are used to do. We evolved, humans evolved to experience the world in large, broad, vast open spaces at the pace of 3 miles an hour. And so the Fulani specifically, while they are the largest nomadic group in the world, the Sahel specifically was because I wanted to be someplace where it's warm.
If you're going to be outside all that time.
Right. So the Alaskan deer herders were out.
There was a lot going on in the region when you were there.
Correct. There was a war that had begun about a year ago in Mali. The front line passed maybe 100 miles north of where my Fulani hosts and I were doing the annual and annular transims. You know, Chris, I spent 15 years covering conflict and conflicts, and I think for me being so close to a war zone was sort of a security blanket type of thing. I wasn't sure what the story would be if I weren't near a conflict zone. And what's interesting is that the war doesn't really factor into this particular book because it didn't really factor very much into the lives of my hosts. And for me professionally, you know, it turned out that it's very interesting to live in peacetime too.
What did it take to convince these people to sort of take you in, allow you to travel with them? How did that process work?
I never can believe how welcoming and accommodating we are. So I have spent, you know, 20 years walking into people's lives, a complete stranger, imposing myself on people. I'm a professional trespasser. Most commonly, people say welcome. And it's astounding and humbling. So I came to Mali. I made a connection with a person who sort of serves as an informal advisor, veterinary legal advisor to this family of Fulani, nomadic Fulani family, who eventually became my hosts, the family of Umaru and Jakaete and Fankta Sankari. And he introduced me to them, and they laughed at the idea that I'd be walking with them. They questioned my ability to walk. They questioned my ability to carry water on my head.
Which wasn't easy,
which was very difficult. And then basically said, okay, sure, you're welcome. Ha.
Let's talk just for a minute about carrying water on your head. This is one of those iconic images that I think people in the West see of women in particular in many parts of the world who must travel long distances every single day to get the water that they need to cook, to clean, to bathe. It really is difficult work, and it takes extraordinary strength, and there's no stopping once you've started.
Well, because you have to drink and eat and do your laundry and wash your dishes. I grew up in the Soviet Union, and my parents and I had a small cabin where we spent our summers, and I used to carry water growing up, not on my head. I would carry two buckets, one in each hand, and it's hard. In Africa, especially... Though in some parts of Asia as well, women mostly carry water on their head. It actually is strangely more convenient to carry heavy stuff on your head, though it hurts your neck, than in both hands. It doesn't challenge your posture as much. But yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard, among other very hard things that you do in life.
Why are the Fulani still living this way, still practicing transhumance, rather than settling, when so many other people who raise cattle have, in fact, decided to stay in one place?
First of all, I need to augment that statement and say there are a lot of settled Fulani. I know Fulani doctors in New York. I know Fulani auto mechanics in Philadelphia. The particular group of Fulani nomads with whom I worked are not settling because they believe that God created the world, all of it, for the cows, and that their job as cowboys is to herd these cows, and the only way they know how to herd cows is to move, which is in part because of the climate in the part of the world where they herd cattle. But also, there is a strong belief that the more cows you have, the better. So to suggest to a nomadic Fulani cattle owner that if he were to decimate his herd but replace the Zebu cattle, which are fairly small, with, say, Holsteins, which would give much more milk, he would save his environment. He would probably prevent his cattle from going very hungry, and it would be much more convenient. That would be a very hard task because this person, the cattle owner, will say, well, how am I going to give up 100 cows and have only 10? That just sounds wrong. Mm-hmm. So there, I think, and that actually is happening. I've met Fulani cow owners who are replacing their large herds with smaller herds of much more milkier, of more milky cows. But it's an educational process that is not taking, it's not happening very fast.
You have a great story in the book, a small story. Some women are getting water from a marshy area, and you're sort of looking at this water and thinking, "How are you sure this is okay?" And they say, well, of course it is. We let the cattle drink from this. And then they looked at your plastic water bottle and said, how do you know who filled that?
Exactly. Exactly. It's the stories we tell ourselves, right? That matter.
Yeah. I loved it because it was just a totally different way of thinking about the world and questioning the things around you and realizing what you don't question.
Mm-hmm. The Fulani tell a lot of stories, and they ask to tell a lot of stories. So a lot of our exchange over the course of the year was an exchange of stories. And, you know, we told stories from the Quran. I told stories about the Big Bang. We told stories about, you know, in which rabbits and hyena are main characters. We told stories about a water folk. West Africa is the birthplace of magical realism. So a lot of the stories are about different spirits. And I could never tell where in that spectrum of stories do my stories fit in. When I tell people that the world, that Earth appeared 14 billion years ago, is it like rabbit and hyena? Hmm. Or is it like the Quran? Or is it like somebody's personal story about from their childhood? How real is it? And what is real? And it really challenged in my imagination, it really challenged the understanding of what real is. Well, what's real for me is one thing, but what's real for my host may be something completely different. The one story that I told, and they were extremely receptive and wanted to hear more stories, but the one story I told that I know for sure they never believed was when I told them that where I come from, there is snow.
Hmm.
They just would not believe the idea of snow. They laughed me out.
They have this great teasing culture, and humor plays a really important role in their lives, which are otherwise pretty hard a lot of the time.
Yes. The idea that humor and joking have to be engendered in an exchange between people. I think I've spoken to a lot of anthropologists about it and historians, and the predominant idea seems to be that these very rigid rules about how to joke and whom you can joke with and what kind of jokes you can tell about other people, and some of them are extremely vulgar and really insulting, came from the need to negotiate common spaces, for example, at market, during which people of different ethnic backgrounds or professional backgrounds come together, and so that they are not fighting in serio, they play fight.
Hmm.
But it's an interesting idea. It's sort of a way to diminish tension.
I don't want to be too reductive, but it sounds like, you know, trash talking on an inner city basketball court rather than getting into a fight.
Very good analogy, I think. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I was thinking is that there are these prescribed rules, who can joke with whom and in what circumstances. Those exist in our culture, too. We just don't think of them that way. There are jokes that you might tell a colleague that you would never tell your grandmother or vice versa.
Well, West African society is very hierarchical. So the older you are, the less people can make fun of you. So if you're, for example, a grandfather, you're male, and it's, you know, a male-dominated society, you're a male elderly person, nobody can touch you. You can do absolutely whatever you like, and nobody can question you. Well, a family can't work that way.
So, not for long, anyway.
Not for long. So there exists the idea that the granddaughter can and the grandson can make fun of the grandfather, thus diminishing the grandfather's standing in this hierarchy of the family and challenging the grandfather on his, you know, as he gets older, probably more and more delusional ideas about the world. And I think that's really healthy and very funny.
There's an interesting way in which wealth is divided. The men own the cattle, the women own the milk.
Yes, it's actually a woman-dominated economy. It's a pre-monetary, pre-modern economy. Fulani don't really do money very much. When they need something, they will barter for it. Men do own everything outside the hearth. So men will own cattle, and they will own, and think of cattle as your sort of retirement fund.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will own some goats and sheep, which are sort of your checking account. If there's an emergency, so say you need to go to the hospital and pay the doctor for medicine, for treatment, then you'll sell a goat. Women own the milk. So men milk the cattle and then hand the milk over to the women. And it's up to the women to decide what to do with the milk. She can give it all to her family for dinner. She can turn it into buttermilk and butter and then barter those for millet and rice. She can spend it all on jewelry for herself, and nobody will have the right to question her.
My guest is journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Thank God KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Anna Bodkin about her new book, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. She's in town for a reading tonight at 7:30 at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. How did you communicate? You had a translator, but there's still the question of things, you know, asides that you can't fully understand. What have you learned about that? Because you've been in this situation multiple times throughout the course of your career.
The anthropologist Paul Stoller once wrote a book called The Sense of Ethnographic Things. And I think that so much of what we experience, we don't experience through language, mm-hmm. even though language is my work, my medium. But I worked with a translator much of the time, not all of the time. Sometimes I would spend days without a translator with the Fulani, with my Fulani hosts. I did take classes, full day classes in Jene in town from a local gentleman. But, you know, do you really need to be able to talk to hold somebody's baby when she's busy, or to carry help carry water, or to help cook a meal? Or you don't really. And what happens, an interesting thing happens when you don't understand really the language. You start paying attention to other things, to gestures, to what people are actually doing with their bodies, what they're doing with the things around them, with the landscape around them, that maybe if you're completely immersed in a conversation, you might not be paying so much attention to the landscape, the weather, the animals. So it's not, maybe it's a handicap, but maybe it's actually something that is useful.
Were there times when you knew that there was, like, does it get frustrating when there's something happening, either someone's trying to tell you something and you don't fully understand? I wonder how you work through that and try to process the experience.
It probably is very frustrating, and I probably get very frustrated. Yeah, well, you know, you understand your limitations. One of the things that Fulani, nomadic Fulani taught me, or at least taught me to try and pay attention to, is the idea of letting go, what you can't control. It's almost this Buddhist-like concept, because imagine when you live and you're constantly on the move, not every day, but, you know, 4, 5, 7 times a year, you move camp. So sometimes you stay in one place for 5 months. Sometimes you stay in one place for 2 weeks. Sometimes you stay in one place for 3 days. And in each of these camps, you meet your relatives, you intersect with them, and then you say farewell. And sometimes you say farewell forever, because who knows what life will bring in the next annual cycle of migration. And the idea that, well, there is something that you simply can't control, you just have to let it go, is very much part of the notion of Fulani-ness, if we can call it this. What's interesting is that we in the West, of course, think of ethnic groups as ethnic groups, haplogroups, if you will. The Fulani think of themselves as a people who have certain qualities, possess certain qualities, and some of these qualities are physical, and some of these qualities are emotional. Stoicism, for example, is one. Being very, not showing grief, not showing emotion is another. Being tall and skinny is another. So it's a mishmash of qualities. And in that, letting go and saying, well, this happened, or well, this didn't happen, is a very important quality. So when I would become frustrated, I would think, well, this is something I can't control. Let's move on.
You came to the conclusion, where a lot of people might look at this and say, well, it's fatalistic. You said, no, this is a way of being hopeful about the world.
Right. It's not the kind of God wills it type of approach. It's an approach of, what's the point of being resentful or remorseful or regretful about something if there is something next coming up and you have to focus on the next thing? But another thing, Chris, is that every time you leave a campground means that you're going to the next campground, which means you're going to say hello to someone. So the cycle of departures is also the cycle of arrivals. So the Fulani who are on the move are constantly departing, but they're also constantly returning, which is very beautiful, I think.
Mali consistently in the modern era has had one of the world's highest rates of child mortality.
Yes.
You saw a lot of sickness, sometimes minor illness that people just had to sort of buck up and deal with, sometimes death.
Yes.
A mother is told, and presumably a father as well, that openly grieving over a dead child will weigh that child's soul down.
Yes, it will close the gates of heaven to the child's soul, and also it will make it so that the child cannot testify for the mother when she dies, which is a lot of burden to carry when you lose a child, which is in itself an unimaginable grief, an unimaginable burden. A part of living a real life and not some sort of enchanted life, exotic life, is that all of these rules are rules. And what we experience in real life and how we actually exhibit our grief is very much human. So I have seen women grieve for their children, and I have grieved for their children with them. And it's not some sort of stoic, imagined, fake experience. It's a very real experience and a very real grief. Mali and Afghanistan compete for the title of a country with the highest infant mortality in the world. On average, 1 in 4 Malian children die before the age of 5, but the rate is much higher among Fulani nomads, whose deaths nobody really tallies, but anthropologists who work with nomadic Fulani say that it's probably half. So imagine losing half your children, and this is what will happen to an average woman who's on the move, an average man who's on the move. So you're on the move from one child's grave to another all the time, which is very, very heavy.
There are some scenes in the book where a young girl is sick. She has this terrible cough, and I can tell that you're really worried about her. Like, if you were in charge, you would have put her to bed and called the doctor and maybe gone to the emergency room. And there's none of that for her.
It's not my place to be in charge. She's not my girl, but I have a child. I have a son. One of the girls in the family, well, actually, there were a handful of girls my son's age in the family that was my host family. And so, of course, I felt very attached to them. And I, you know, I don't know how to describe it on the radio or otherwise, how it feels when you can think, oh, my God, she's as old as my son. You know, this is what's happening to her. Well, I am a guest, maybe an honored guest. Maybe I have opinions that my hosts will listen to. There was a little girl who was on the verge of, she almost died from starvation because her mother had stopped eating any protein and she stopped lactating, but the girl only nursed. So for weeks, probably, she nursed absolutely empty breasts. And she was sick. She got malaria. I bought her some medicine. The medicine didn't seem to help or help temporarily, but then it stopped helping. The girl was very sick. And finally, it was actually the translator I was working with who put his foot down and he said, look, I am going to put you on my motorcycle and ride you to the hospital with your daughter today. It's urgent. And he's, you know, he's local. He's a city boy, but he's local and they trusted him. And he could say this because he has the kind of relationship with that family that I don't have. And so she did go to the hospital, and it was just in a nick of time, really. She doctors saved her, but she was almost a year old, maybe a little bit older than a year, and she weighed what my son weighed at birth. So she was severely malnourished and had all sorts of complications, post-malaria complications and tuberculosis and, you know, a whole slew of these killer, preventable killer diseases that we hear about a lot. And now she's almost three and she's walking and she's healthy.
How did the Fulani react to the fact that you had one child?
They felt very sorry for me. Very sorry. They felt very sad for me that I only had one because, well, one thing is that, you know, if you're expecting to lose half of your children, then it's simply not very smart to only have one child. But also, you know, it's a sign of some sort of deficiency. I also was not married. I'm not married. So that's another sign of this poor Anna.
Did they try to encourage you to have relationships with anyone there? Was that something in their minds or because you were a foreigner that just wasn't something that they
Well, I don't know what was in their minds. I know that they one of the women tried to comfort me one time and she said, don't worry, you will get married. It will be okay. We'll dance at your marriage. It will be fine.
You do write in the book you had had a relationship end at the time that you undertook this journey. I wonder how living among these people helped you to frame your own grief over the end of the relationship.
I don't know that it did. I do think that the grief that I was feeling informed much of what I saw the way I saw it. I think I was probably more attuned to the idea of loss among my hosts. Of course, there is no control group. There is no Anna who goes that same year, spends time with those same people, but, you know, is happy. But, you know, I learned that you can't rely on a lifestyle or a change of scenery to walk out of grief, but that you can rely on being attentive to walk into beauty. So that was something that I carried away.
How concerned are the Fulani who live this nomadic life that their young people will see the allure of living in a city, getting a job somewhere, and move away from this life that their ancestors have known for thousands of years?
Very, very concerned, and they're very disapproving. And I know a lot of nomadic families who would have one child or maybe more than one child who would disappear into a city. Because you go to the market, even if you live in the bush and you're a Fulani person who's completely nomadic, once a week you'll go to the market just to see other Fulani, your friends, who will also go to the market. And you'll mill around the cattle row and then you'll go out and, you know, maybe we'll sell a goat and buy some meat to eat, which is a treat, and maybe some, you know, some fabric to make some new clothes. And then you'll see not helicopters, you'll see motorcycles, you'll see radios, you want to have music, so you buy yourself a cell phone and you put music on a memory card and put that memory card into, well, you have to have money for all of that stuff. You can't swap a goat for a cell phone. Right. So if you want to have things, of which there are more and more in the market nowadays, then you have to have money to buy it with. And the only way to have money is to have a job that pays money, or you start selling off your cattle for money. And spending that money, and then that money ends. And there are many sad stories that elders will tell their children, you know, sort of educational warning stories. Well, here is this young man who had inherited thousands of head of cattle and sold it all because he wanted wealth, and then he spent all the wealth, and now he's so embarrassed, you know, he won't show his face, and then sort of wait and look at the faces of their children to see if the lesson had sunk in.
All over the world, people who own land aren't necessarily keen to have others wandering over that land with hungry cattle, with cattle that are thirsty. There have been conflicts between settled neighbors and the nomadic Fulani.
This is a biblical conflict, right? The conflict of Cain and Abel.
Which is where your title comes from.
Which is where one of the places where the title comes from. And what's even more makes it even more difficult for the nomads is that governments really don't like nomads. Nomads are uncontrollable. You can't tally them. You can't. They can't really pay taxes because you can't track them down. It's hard to track them down. You can try and enforce vaccination laws on their cattle by threatening to take all cattle away and kill it and maybe scare them into vaccinating cattle. But you know, what about the people? They could be obedient taxpayers sitting in some place, but in fact, they're on the move all the time. And governments don't like that. Governments like borders and settled peoples. And the Fulani, which nomadic Fulani, which exist in 17 countries across West Africa, across the Sahel, they're running into very similar problems with governments of all of these countries. In Nigeria, there is a very concerted effort on behalf of the government to settle down all the Fulani people. In Mali, Mali simply doesn't have the means to do anything like that. But there's certainly, the Fulani get fleeced a lot by the government because the government realizes that the Fulani can be fleeced. They have cattle. Cattle can be expensive. They can, you know, if we arrest a Fulani man for carrying a knife and say that he was using that knife or planning to use that knife to, say, cut down some endangered trees and say that he must pay a $100 fine, he will be so scared and lost that he will probably pay a $100 fine. You can't do that to a farmer because the farmer simply doesn't have the money. You know, a farmer is much poorer, the millet farmer or the rice farmer. So the Fulani are sort of, the nomadic Fulani are sort of, you know, caught between expanding farmland and the government that doesn't like them and a war that is encroaching on their ancient routes of transhumance. It's a difficult life. They must be very inventive in how they adapt.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. She's in town to read tonight at 7:30 at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Anna Bodkin. Her new book is called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Anna, are the Fulani interested in at all in political participation in suffrage?
Mali had had Fulani presidents. But these were not nomadic Fulani presidents, mm-hmm. of course. The nomads, whom I know, don't really have a very clear idea of what the political process is, what a political process is, or what Mali is, or what Africa is. You know, let's start from the beginning. In order to want to participate in a political process, maybe we need an understanding of, well, what does it even mean? My hosts were completely illiterate. They actually did not know what Africa was. Mali, they said, Mali, what is Mali? And somebody said, well, Mali is the Bambara name for hippo, which it is. It's mm-hmm. the name for a hippopotamus. So what is a president? It's like the person in charge of what? Will he give me more rain? Will he make the clouds break and have a normal rainy season? Will he protect my cows from being killed by farmers? What is in it for me? Why should I care? So The answer is for nomads, no. For Fulani in general, of course, yes. Like I said, there have been Fulani politicians, not just in Mali, but in other West African countries, but not my hosts.
This is not your first experience really getting to intimately know people who don't have formal education. But I wonder throughout the course of your career, what you've learned about recognizing the intelligence of people who have never opened a book and don't maybe measure intelligence in the same way that we've been taught to do in the West. But it's got to be evident certain people are great with numbers, certain people are great with words, certain people are very creative.
Well, it certainly taught me not to measure intelligence in terms of how many books people have read. And kindness and generosity doesn't come from learning. It comes from within, or maybe from communality, from the sense of community. It teaches me again and again that wealth comes not from education, and I'm not talking about physical wealth, I'm talking about emotional wealth. It comes from someplace much deeper, from a place into which we all can choose to reach, I think. I have extremely close friendships with my hosts. It is beyond a friendship. It's you know, this is a group of people who have tolerated me for a year or maybe more. And I have a relationship with them. I will call them, you know, if not tonight, it's a little getting a little late in the day, but tomorrow, to let them know how things are going, because they've heard of Texas, of course, because they've seen on the television a screen of one of their friends who lives in town and has a television and a screen. They have seen Texans, and they said they also love cows, and they have hats that are like the Fulani hats, only bigger. So I will tell them that I'm in the land of other cowboys who have hats like the Fulani hats, only bigger, and the idea that I'm talking about their life here will be interesting to them. So we're in a constant conversation. These are very, very dear people to me. I don't care what their education level is.
I was surprised to read that they make some value judgments based on skin color. And is that something that is left over from the influence of colonialism? Did that predate the arrival of Europeans who assumed that everybody would agree that they were superior?
I think bigotry begins when we have to make a choice. Am I going to be protecting my child or your child? So if I am in a situation where only one child will survive, let's say in a cave 100,000 years ago, I am altruistic because that's another feature that is very human, but I'm also bigoted because I have to be. Because if I'm not, then I will accidentally save your child and mine will die, and so my family will die. I believe that bigotry is natural to all humans. The question is, what do we do with it? Do we acknowledge it and work with it, or do we go along with it? The idea of the other, dividing the world into myself and the other, has its manifestations in colonizations or slavery or other ways of political and social repression all over the world. But these are just manifestations. In fact, we are dividing the world into ourselves and the other all the time, and we have been doing it since Cain and Abel.
If you're practicing transhumance, even if you have accumulated a good deal of wealth in the form of cattle, there's only so much other stuff that you can take with you. I wonder how the Fulani think about possessions and what is worth owning and carrying every single time you go somewhere, and what is ridiculous to be encumbered with?
Well, it depends on your gender and your age. A Fulani man will carry a bottle of worm killer and a syringe in case the cattle get worms. and probably a little metal teapot, because how can you possibly live without tea, which is very, very sweet, syrupy tea, and it's boiled over a small fire. A Fulani woman will carry some calabashes for her milk, some gourds. She will carry some spoons to cook with, or cooking sticks. She will carry, of course, a couple of pots that she will cook with. These are cast iron pots, and the cast iron pots are fascinating because they're the same pots I've seen all over the world. I've seen cast iron pots in Chechnya. I've seen these very same cast iron pots in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in India. They're all shaped the same. So it's like this one communal pot of the world made of cast iron. She will carry blankets for herself, for her children, for her family. That's about it. Though I have seen a family migrate with a half-eaten mango among many, among the things that the not many things that the family carried from their dry season camp to their rainy season camp were two mangoes, one of which they had started eating. So, you know, there you go. Why throw away a perfectly good thing?
The last really severe period of famine was in the 70s and 80s for the people that you traveled with. Was that based? Was that because of drought?
That was a drought. That was a terrible drought. Droughts are not rare in the Sahel, and the Sahel had always been battered by drought. At a certain point in the history of mankind, droughts would come every 100 years or so. In the last century, there were three or four big, severe droughts. Recently, droughts have been battering the Sahel in rapid fire succession. And people who study these things, meteorologists, predict that in a dozen years or so, it will be just one big drought because of climate change. So the Fulani are having to adapt very rapidly to the idea that there never will be enough water again, that there never be enough pasturage again, which is why the idea of swapping zebus for Holsteins is very appealing in my opinion. But, you know, again, it's very difficult to wrap your mind around having experienced such tremendous loss of cattle to drought. You know, in the lifespan of my host, Umaru Jakayete, His father was extremely wealthy. He had thousands of cattle, and Umaru has just a few dozen. So he had lost so many to drought and famine. And for him to say, okay, I'm going to have even fewer cows, that is very hard to imagine him agreeing to do.
They have understood climate change and its effects, even if they don't understand what climate change is.
They can describe with absolute precision the symptoms of climate change. The hotter, drier winds that are blowing stronger from the Sahel, because from the savannah, because the Sahara Desert is becoming larger and encroaching on the savannah, so it creates a larger swath of land in which the wind can blow. So the wind picks up speed, it picks up sand, it blows sand farther south. These periods of hot, windy seasons are becoming longer, more extended. Rain comes not when it's expected to come. It's out of whack with the stars that the Fulani used to expect weather. Now they can't expect weather. And it's very difficult because the idea that they can't rely on the weather is very hard.
They are custodians of their animals, caretakers of their animals. Do they have a sort of individual relationship to the cattle in their care?
They know each one. They know each one by name. Each one is named by color. So the hide of the cow determines the name of the cow. The Fulani are able to tell a herd of a friend or a relative from a distance of, you know, 3 miles, which is how far we can usually see because of the curvature of the earth. They can see a herd adumbrate on the horizon and say, this is the herd of such and such. And the younger person will say, how do you know? And the older person will say, I just know. That's just how it is. when I see cattle, I know. And they can, during a major cattle drive, when many herds come together, they can identify each of their cows in that gigantic herd and separate them out of the big herd. And I've asked a teenage boy how he does it, and he said, they were born into my hands.
Yeah, teenagers have a great deal of responsibility, even younger than that, for these cattle. The boys start caring for them as young as 7 years old.
A seven-year-old boy can herd cattle on his own during the dry season when the cattle doesn't have to go very far, and mostly when the cattle somehow knows where to go. So the boy will literally follow the cattle and then follow them back. The rite of passage for a young Fulani man, which happens to be sometime between the ages of 15 and 18, is to take cattle by himself on from the dry season pasturage to rainy season pasturage and bring it back and care for it during the rainy season and make sure that there are more cows that he brings back than the cows he'd left with.
And how does he start to own his own cattle?
When his father died.
You were talking about the names of each individual animal. You were also given a special name by your hosts that I guess told you you were welcome.
Or that I'm a good cow. In West Africa, names are very meaningful. And I was told that in order to be more welcome, exactly, more easily welcome into the community, that I had to have a Fulani name. So several elders participated in the naming ceremony. I was named Anaba. Ba is a very, very old one of the names of Fulani progenitor families. There are four Fulani progenitor families that are believed to have come to West Africa from Ethiopia, and Ba is one of them. So it's a very, very noble name, which I'm very proud of. It also is a name of one of the most famous Malian writers, Amadou Hampate Ba, who was a scholar, a historian, a retailer of fairy tales in French, an educator, and a beautiful writer. So it's very nice to share a last name with Monsieur Ba. So that's my name. People in Mali know me as Anaba.
And what was the ceremony like?
I bought a goat. It was slaughtered. A very good butcher slaughtered it and cooked it on a grill. And a lot of very beautifully dressed Fulani elders came and raised toasts with orange Fanta and promised that my name will bring me luck and happiness, and that if I really wanted to be Fulani, I needed to marry a Fulani man, and they can help me with that too.
Still waiting on that part. Anna Bodkin's new book is called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. She will speak tonight at Wild Detectives Bookstore in Dallas. Anna, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for stopping in.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.